have come here this evening to share Dhamma together. And by the act of choosing to be here, choosing to share this space and this time together, we're making a significant commitment and a significant effort towards this goal of spiritual practice, and something which we recognize as of value in our lives, something that we recognize is worth sacrificing for, putting aside the other concerns that we might have, making space, making time. And this is not something which we should take for granted. It's so easy to not make the time. So easy to treat Dhamma and the spiritual life as being the least important thing in our life. Actually, it should be the most important thing. And Dhamma is something which can give an orientation and a depth and a resonance to everything else that we do. When I was in Thailand and went to an ordination ceremony of some of my good friends, I was ordained shortly after I was. And the ordination teacher, Ajahn Mahamon, said talked about this Thai dessert. See, because if you're living in Thailand, then everything comes back to food eventually, right? He talked about what they call gui bort chi, which literally means bananas ordained as nuns. In Thailand, the nuns wear these white robes, and bananas ordained as nuns is bananas which are cooked in coconut oil, coconut milk, so that they're all in white, like the nuns in their white robes, and so he was saying, just like the bananas, when they're cooked in coconut milk, are much richer and sweeter and more delicious than ordinary bananas. The same thing with the ordained life is much richer and sweeter and more delicious than ordinary life. So that's the flavor of Dhamma that our life has when it has a Dhamma in it. I don't know about you, but I think for many of us, certainly for myself, in coming to Dhamma, there was a strong feeling of a need for meaning and a search for meaning. And this is something that's been important for me as long as I can remember. And so there are various things that I thought were providing me with meaning and providing me with happiness, my friends, relationships, my music, and so on. And they all provided me with something, some kind of sustenance, some kind of sense of who I am, a way of expression and some kind of a sense of wholeness. And yet there's also a sense in which those things are very limited, and a sense in which they can just take you so far. After I did my first retreat in Thailand, and when I first went over to Thailand, I'd tried to get work in Chiang Mai playing music in the various nightclubs and restaurants and so on around town playing guitar, and nobody was interested to give me a job. And so I did this meditation retreat for a month. And that retreat was a very profound experience for me. I went through a lot of different phases during the retreat, periods of intense suffering and physical pain, tears and crying, periods of great joy and lightness of heart, sort of crammed almost like a whole lifetime of feeling and experience and wisdom and foolishness and into just a month. And one of the things which I learned, one of the things which I noticed, was how this notion of reflection, of looking back into oneself, and of understanding the nature of my own mind. You know, we talk about doing meditation, we talk about, you know, understanding your mind, or finding peace of mind, or finding happiness, and so on. But because these are just like ideas, you know, we have an idea of what these things are. But our experience of these things, if we haven't done any deep meditation, our experience of these things is very shallow. It's very, I really think before I did that retreat, I really just don't think I knew what those things meant. If you said to me, peace of mind, I really don't think I would have known what that meant. The clarity of awareness, these are kind of notions which had no meaning for me. And even though, I'm somebody who I always kind of like to read, and so I'm, you know, reasonably well educated. I kind of read the great novelists and the great philosophers, and taken an interest in science and the philosophy of science and so on. And had a reasonable kind of knowledge, certainly in terms of the Western sort of intellectual sphere. And yet I've never really come across this idea, this basic idea, this fundamental idea of reflecting and looking directly into one's own mind. And this idea which is actually right at the heart of the entire Indian tradition. It's very much a characteristic of the Indian sort of philosophical spiritual tradition. Not just Buddhism, but all of the Indian traditions. And so if you told me about these things or talked to me about them, they would have just kind of drifted by me. I wouldn't really have seen what these things mean. And so it was when I had the chance to spend this time on retreat that I really started to apprehend these things for the first time. And one of the great things about that particular retreat was that they didn't teach you anything. So they basically just told you to meditate. So this is how you meditate, and you just did it. And they didn't give any. There was no Dhamma talks on the retreat, no teaching, no framework, nothing. And so I basically had no nothing really to help me get through that, except for my own dogged persistence. But not just dogged persistence, but somehow inside me there was a seed of faith. And I don't know where that comes from, and I don't know why I've had it, but it's always been there. And I remember actually even much earlier in my life, you know, brought up in a Catholic family and so on, I never had much contact with Buddhism. And, you know, in those days, and like in the 70s and that, then Buddhism was not nearly as prevalent as it is today. So, you know, I kind of let go of my Catholic beliefs when I was a teenager. And... But there were a few times. I remember one, I used to be, one of the things I used to be part of, Animal Liberation. And I remember one of the members of the group, it was someone who was really, just had this kind of something special about her. I'm not quite sure. She's this kind of older lady and who just had some kind of bit of an aura, a bit of charisma, a bit of a kind of a zing to her presence. And then somebody said, oh yeah, she's a Buddhist meditator. And there's a kind of connection there, kind of a feeling of connection, but I didn't really follow it through. Or another example was a friend of mine called Ross Bolitar, who, if you're familiar with the Zen circles in Australia, you might be familiar with. He became a Roshi in the Diamond Sangha. And when I knew him in the 1980s, he was a Zen meditator, but I knew him as a particularly mad musician. And among all of the mad musicians that I knew, he was possibly the maddest. And he used to do things like, he used to travel into the middle of the West Australian desert and go to abandoned farmhouses and find ruined pianos in old sheds, and then sit there and record music on these things for hours on end and make records of this ruined piano music and various kinds of things like that. He did another one where he had a group, improvisation group, and they played a gig at a convention of astronomers in the WA University. And they received they got the signal from a pulsar, and received it at a radio telescope in New South Wales, and then beamed via satellite, and then put through a synthesizer with these things in coming out in these kind of random sounds, unpredictable, being beamed from the cosmos, and then they had to sort of jam with this thing as it was happening at the astronomers' conference. And so, these are the kinds of things which he'd get up to. And but he was a beautiful piano player, and we got him to do some recording with us, and we had this very lovely sort of ballad which our singer Peggy had written. And so I invited Ross to come and play piano on this thing. And you know, it's a very kind of lovely kind of plaintive, sorrowful love song kind of thing. And Ross immediately came in. We invited him to play piano. He immediately started taking the cymbals off the drum kit, putting them inside the piano, and plucking the strings and playing like slide piano. We were sort of standing around and saying, Ross, do you want a chord chart or something like that at all? Anything you want? And he was a Buddhist as well, and a meditator. And again, I kind of knew that, and there was some kind of respect for that. And but it didn't take it any further. So I had these kind of encounters during my life. So somehow, I don't know why, I guess maybe it's from past lives or something like that, but there was some kind of seed of faith that I've always had in me, and which I think is, for me, is quite interesting to reflect on. That I for some reason, I'm not sure why, I've got this very, very deep faith in the Dhamma. And so when I came to this retreat, of course there were many things that I could have doubted about. Yeah? Is this the right place? Are they teaching the right way? What should I be doing? Blah, blah, blah. So I could have made a big problem out of it. But for some reason, I just plunged into it. And there were a lot of other, it was a retreat center. They had, Westerners and travelers and so on practicing there. So a lot of people did have problems, and there were a lot of people having doubts and complaints and so on about the place. But I just got on with my practice. And I found it to be enormously beneficial. And I remember one day, one afternoon, coming out in the late afternoon. This was in the hot season in Chiang Mai, so it was very hot and stifling weather. I'm coming out in the middle of the afternoon and just sitting quietly under the trees and having a cup of tea or something like that. And just really noticing for the first time, these little moments that you just never forget, just really noticing for the first time that my awareness had just become so clear. And I could see it, all the colours were vibrant and alive. Everything I could hear was clarified and purified and vivid. Everything I taste, if I'm drinking the cup of tea or something, everything in my experience was just so much more alive. You know, it's like switching over from black and white telly to colour telly or something like that, or from a mono sound to stereo sound or something like that. It just, everything had come alive. And so this is how gradually I came to realise the profundity and the importance of this contemplation and this understanding of awareness. What is that in there? What is that sense of awareness, that sense of knowing? And when I went through many different kinds of experiences on that retreat. It was a very intensive retreat. We're practicing 14 hours a day for a month, and then at the end of the retreat they have a special little thing at the end there where you don't sleep for a few days. So you just practice for, I think, 4 days I did at the end, where you don't sleep, just meditate through the night. And of course, if you don't go mad, which is decidedly possible, then you certainly investigate some interesting states of understanding of certainly the First Noble Truth. It becomes quite apparent to you those early hours of the night. But very fascinating to see also, because of that process, that reflective process, bringing everything back, constantly bringing everything back, constantly bringing everything back, constantly reflecting, constantly bringing the mind back into oneself. And then it just develops this kind of this self-generating process, or the self-energizing process, so that by the end of that period, actually, the final day, you really just feel fine. You don't really feel tired or sleepy or anything like that. You feel quite fine. And then I remember going along to my last interview on the retreat. And they sort of did that, and then they said, okay, your retreat's over now. Congratulations. And you sort of go back to your room, and then you think, oh, what do I do now? Oh, maybe might as well do some meditation. I don't have anything else to do. And that time when I went back and I did have that sit, that was one of the most profound sits that I had, and I can still remember that particular time, and I was just kind of sitting there. It was around midday, and just kind of sitting, and it felt like everything just dropped away, just boom, just look, almost like I could look down, as everything just became like sitting on a well, as everything fell away, and there was just nothing left. Just this kind of abyss. But that's just a perception, it's just a way of seeing. So this is what I learned during that retreat, is that there are these different ways of seeing. And when I came out, you know, is it karma, is it developing a baramis or merit or whatever it is, I don't know. But I went back to the guest house where I'd been staying in Chiang Mai. And the owners of the guest house said to me that they wanted to adopt me as their son in Thailand. And they said, stay here as long as you like. You don't have to pay anything for the room. And, you know, we'll give you all the food and meals and things you need. And the owner of the guest house went to school with Thailand's biggest rock band, or second biggest rock band. And he knew all the musicians in town, so they'd find me plenty of gigs playing music around town and recording and blah, blah, blah. And so that's what I ended up doing, staying there, and I'd go and play two or three gigs per night. And in the daytime, go to the monastery and study Abhidhamma. And the other thing I did, which was really fun, was I used to did some English teaching in some of the villages around Chiang Mai. So I used to go around to the little villages and teach English to the little kids there, which was great fun. So I was doing all of these things. And so one of the things I noticed about, you know what I was doing with playing music, meditation that I'd done and the skills that I'd learned through meditation were definitely something that I could bring to music and bring to learning that craft of playing the guitar in a very positive way. And I actually became very very diligent. I was practicing a lot, and both in terms of doing formal practice, but also in terms of being very creative and so on in that period of time. And so, you know, I could really see that positive benefit of meditation as being something that could be applied, you know, to, I mean, that was just my particular craft. That's what I did. I played guitar, so I brought it to that. And, you know, you can really see the benefits of that, absolutely. And I had no doubt that there was of tremendous benefit in pursuing that. But I could also see that on the other side of that was a sense of emptiness. And that was, I guess, a function of where I was at in my personal development. That perhaps I'd grown or done what I needed to do with music and playing guitar and those kinds of things. And so even though, you know, in a sense I was becoming a better musician or better guitar player than I'd ever been, but also it didn't mean anything to me anymore. It didn't mean anything. And it had done my whole adult life. It had been one of the main things that I'd done to provide that sense of meaning, sense of identity and so on. Maybe I just didn't need it anymore. Maybe I'd outgrown it. Maybe, I don't know why. But you could see that whatever it was very external. Yeah, it's an external expression. And compared with the depth, the refinement, the subtlety of meditation, then anything that I was able to do with my fingers and my hands and playing guitar was very, is so limited and so coarse and so shallow. So there was this kind of two-sided thing. On one side, the ability to actually enhance those worldly things, which definitely was there, but also a sort of a deeper sense of meaning, like a deeper kind of current, which was leading me in another direction. So I kind of juggled with these different things for a period of time before, of course, as you can see, fairly obvious which choice I made in the end. But one of the things that I also found in that period, which I was very difficult but quite striking, was quite a strong sense of alienation. In, you know, just in being with people and talking with people, you know, after I'd come out of my retreat, I just felt most people that I met just didn't get it. They just didn't understand. And I found it very difficult to communicate about the things that were important to me. Yeah, and so, you know, you're sort of staying in a backpackers and there's tourists around and they're going shopping and they're going on treks and they're going to nightclubs and all of this kind of stuff. And it just didn't mean anything to me anymore. Not that it meant much to me beforehand. It certainly didn't mean anything to me afterwards. So sometimes people come to me and ask me for their advice. You know, how do you practice the Dhamma while living in the world? And of course, I don't know why they come to me for advice on that. I'm a complete failure at trying to practice Dhamma while living in the world. That's why I became a monk. But I can certainly appreciate the problem, yeah? And this is, I think, one of the things the Buddha said was so important was called kalyana mittata, is good friendship and spiritual support. And that's one of the great things that we have in staying in a monastery is, you know, you're around people who they get it, they understand, yeah? What's meditation? Why do you want to spend time sitting by yourself in a hut in the middle of the forest? Yeah? We share a set of values, we share a direction, and so that's very mutually supportive all the time. You know, it's this kind of undercurrent of shared beliefs and so on. So this is something which, you know, hopefully this little group that we have on a Friday night does something to provide that for each of you. It provides a place where you can come and also meet other people interested in Dhamma, interested in meditation, and that will help to support you in your practice, to realize that you're not alone. You're not the only weird person in the world. There are others just as weird. So that's always nice. There's a sense of, there's something good about that. So, one of the problems of spiritual practice or something as we go on is that the our original insight, you know, if I look back at my time as a practitioner, you know, you get that original insight is very much into a personal and spiritual experience. So it's just, how does that feel within myself? What is that sense of knowing? And then understanding thought. Okay, this is my thoughts going down in that direction. Now understanding emotion, looking at the different way emotions move in the body and so on. Understanding, seeing something about perception. Yeah, understanding how the mind is creating its realities and its fantasies out of the sense data which is presented to it. So we're sort of deconstructing and understanding the nature of our own experience and realizing that, of course, this is all impermanent, this is all uncertain, this is all conditioned. It's always changing. And as we look deeper and deeper within that, we try to find, well, who am I? Right? There's this question of not self in Buddhism. Who am I? Yeah? And that's for people who haven't done spiritual practice, then that's, of course, a very banal question. You say, well, my name's Anthony Best. I'm a guitar player. I was born in Perth in 1966 and blah, blah, blah. And that's who I am. You have this kind of sense of identity. But the deeper we go into meditation, the closer you look at it, the more it breaks up, the more it disappears. What actually is the I? What am I? And this is not dissimilar to what happens, for example, the same thing happens actually if you look closely at anything, you know. So, even for the physicists, you look at matter, and you say, "What is matter?" And you, the further you go into it, you see matter is made up of atoms. You say, "Well, the idea of an atom really is just a kind of an abstraction. It's not really atoms. There's these kind of energy things moving in space or something like that. But even space is not really space." And then there's these kind of string things, maybe, but we don't really know what strings are, or if they are, any of them. And they're wrapped up in 11 dimensions or something like that. So you kind of begin, it used to be just a table. It was so simple, I could just put my cup on it, and there it was. Yeah? Now I'm worried because I put my cup on it, and it's just going to disappear through the top of the table. I don't know. And once you ask that question, like, what is matter? You know, from a physicist's point of view, we'll say, well, actually, it's the wrong kind of question to be asking. Because what you're asking, you're assuming. The question assumes that there is this kind of solid stuff called matter. And actually, when we look into the nature of physical reality, we don't really find anything that corresponds to matter as such. It's just a concept that we use that has a certain utility for certain kinds of questions. And so Buddhism has exactly the same attitude towards this idea of the self, or the I, the identity. You ask, who am I? When we start out, then this seems like a relevant question. But the further we go into our practice, it actually becomes quite a misleading question. You ask, who am I? Means there is an I. Which I can identify with. There's an I somewhere in there. And the Buddha said, actually, we shouldn't ask this question. Yeah? This is one of because it's already assuming the answer that there is a self. So that teaching of not self is much more radical. So perhaps we should ask, instead of who am I, we should ask, what is there? Or what is happening? Perhaps it's a better. Whatever question we ask, we're going to reach the end of it somewhere. And whatever sense of identity, sense of self that we have, when we investigate that point of what I am, that point will dissolve. And so one of the paradoxes of spiritual practice is that having come into Buddhism from a sense of wanting to dissolve, or feeling a sense of dissolving of self, a dissolving of identity, dissolving of attachments and all of these things, you then decide to get attached to being a Buddhist. You get a sense of identity. Who are you? Oh, I'm a Buddhist monk. Yeah. So you get something, it's a whole new set of things that you can get attached to. And that can be quite a trap. And certainly among the monastic community, there are many things that we can get attached to. You know, we're from the greatest lineage. Yeah? We're from the noble lineage of the forest masters. Yeah? And so we can be very proud of that. The fact that the forest masters got to be masters because they got rid of their pride is another matter entirely. So, you know, we can think, oh, we're Buddhists, you know, And we believe in reason and truth and not kind of blind faith like all those other religions. So you get a sense of pride about your religion. Buddhism is good because you don't have to believe your ancient scriptures. You see? It says so in our ancient scriptures. Yeah? And so you can get the sense of pride about being a Buddhist. Yeah, and you can think that Buddhism's so good that it becomes a way of say, putting down people who have different beliefs, or people who have a different believe in a different kind of Buddhism. There was a joke about that. This fellow's walking along a road, comes to a bridge, and there's a man on the bridge about to throw himself off, about to kill himself. And the other man says, "Wait," he says, "my friend," he says, don't do it." He says, "You know, do you believe in God?" He says, "Yes." He says, "I believe in God." He says, "And what you know?" So we both believe in God together. He says, "You know, but are you like a Catholic or a Protestant?" He says, "Oh, I'm a Protestant." He says, "Well, you know, be Baptist or whatever." He says, "I'm from Baptist." He says, "But are you from the pre-Reform Baptist or the post-Reform Baptist?" He says, "Well, from the post-Reform." "Was that with the Reform of 1874 or the Reform of 1892?" He says, "From the Reform of 1892." He says, "Well, throw yourself off then." So that's a very true statement about the nature of our religious beliefs. Starts out all very well, doesn't it? Yeah? If you look at all the great religions and things, they all start out well. And they start out with an expansion. Yeah? They all start out with an expansion of our sense of humanity, an expansion of our sense of love, our expansion of our sense of connectedness and understanding, and letting go of our pettiness and of our narrow-mindedness and all of those things. And it's that same expansion which is the speciality of the meditative experience, that letting go of the narrowness and the boundaries and the tightness around our sense of who we are in the world. And in the experience of meditation, all of those things dissolve and they go away. So this is one of the great things about Buddhism, is that it gives us the means to do this. It doesn't just talk about it, but it gives us the means, the actual contemplative practices which allow us to dissolve our boundaries. But when that's happened, and when afterwards the habits kick in, the mind tends to go back to the same ways of thinking. We tend to get attached to who we are. We get attached to this particular meditation method. Our method is right, the other method is wrong. Get attached to our school of Buddhism. Theravada is the real authentic teaching of the Buddha. And all those Mahayanists all completely lost the plot. Or else you say, "Oh, well, you know, Buddhists are right, and all the Christians and Muslims and everything, they just believe in blind faith in this God that doesn't exist." You know, or whatever it is, at whatever level, these things can kick back in. Like kind of that idea, the narrow-mindedness, the literalness, all of those things which we were practicing in order to overcome in the first place. So it's important that we notice this, and that we allow, or that we help and we facilitate the movement between and the integration between these two different spheres. So this sphere of the inner contemplative life, the realization of the truth of one's own consciousness, and then also that aspect of our life which is moving in the world, which is communicating, which is relating, which is making a living, which is constructing an environment, a home that we live in. And those two parts, the two aspects of our spiritual life, need to be in constant communication. And if there's a boundary sticks between those things, then our spiritual practice will not be mature, will not be integrated. So one of the reasons why I've started to think along these lines and this kind of notion of identity or what it means to be a Buddhist, because we were talking just before the talk this evening, we were talking about the terrible situation at the moment in Sri Lanka with the fighting that's been going on there for so long. And of course it's one of the great tragedies of this conflict is that religion has become a part of it, and that religious ideology is used by both sides, by some people on both sides, in order to justify the conflict and justify the war. And of course this is very sad, and it's especially sad in the case of Buddhism, where of course you don't really have any excuse. I mean, if you want to look in the Bible, for example, and find some warlike passages to justify your actions, well, you can find plenty. You can find plenty of peaceful passages as well. But in the Buddhist scriptures, you can't actually find any warlike passages to justify your acts. But nevertheless, it still happens. And so, you know, of course, the causes of war and conflict are very complex. And the social, political dimensions of it are very important. But I think the as this conflict seems to be coming into its last phase, and we're all, I'm sure, very concerned about the fate, especially of the civilians, the innocent, who get caught up in these things, and who suffer the danger from other people's ideologies and other people's issues. And so I would just like to remind you to spare a thought for those people, and also to do what we can. I'm sure there's now a huge refugee problem which is emerging because of that. And they were saying before that some of the temples and so on are starting to organize help for the refugees. So if you can all do what we can to support that, I think this is very important. And it's particular, of course, it's always important to do this from just a humanitarian basis, to realize that these people are suffering and that they need help. But even more so in this particular case, because the religious response to the aftermath of this conflict is going to be a major factor which will determine whether the long-term scars and wounds in Sri Lanka are able to heal themselves. And if the Buddhist community is shown to be very proactive, very compassionate, and very offering a helping hand and a healing hand to try to repair things as best as possible, then that will be for the long term for the great benefit of those people who have been afflicted so badly in this conflict. So it's just an appeal for everybody right now to spare some thought and to try to do what we can to help the people in that situation.